Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber, and I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday season and a peaceful and healthy new year. I also want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for all your support. This has been a great year for us, and I'm really excited about all the cool new things we'll be doing next year and all the great guests we already have lined up. We'll actually be dropping episode number 400 of fresh new content coming up soon on January 15th, and I never could have done this without you, so thanks. This last week of December 2018, and also next week, the first week of January 2019, I'm taking some time off. During this time, we'll be rebroadcasting some of the most popular episodes of Everyone Loves Guitar. In addition, at the beginning of each of these shows, I'm going to give you some brief commentary about my recollection of the overall interview experience I had with whatever individual we're airing that day. Again, sincere thanks for listening and for all your support. If you ever want to get a hold of me, go to the contact tab on everyonelovesguitar.com website. I'm fairly inundated with email, to be honest with you, and with work in general. So while I may not be able to answer your specific message, I do read all the messages and comments I get. Thanks again for your support. Now let's get busy with today's show. Today's rebroadcast is of my interview with Kazem Sultan. This was a really weird interview for me because it was one of those, I'm not a guy that gets starstruck, but it was one of those interviews where I remember picking up LPs, you know, like vinyl when I was a kid, and looking at the back of them and seeing Kazem Sultan's name on there. So it was a real like trip because, I've said a number of times, you can't connect the dots moving forward. But if someone would have told, 15-year-old Craig, hey, man, you'll be talking with this guy in a really frank conversation one day, I would have been like, what? So it was a kind of a trip to have this conversation with Kazem. What I remember about this interview is, first of all, he's a cigar smoker. I'm a cigar smoker. And he's sitting down, I believe, in his basement up in New York. He lights his cigar, and I wanted one so badly. It was like, it was like watching someone eat ice cream when you're hungry or something like that, right? And I just wanted to sit and smoke a cigar with him. Like, we're on Skype looking at each other, and I was like, and I said, what are you smoking? I think he was smoking an Arturo Fuente, which is generally a pretty good cigar. So I was like, yeah, man, I dig that. So that was the first thing I remember. He's got some really intense stories on here. I mean, he talks about, first of all, he's been with Todd Rundgren for 40 years. That's like, beyond getting the company watch, right? That's a crazy amount of time. That's lifetime. And he almost didn't get the gig with Todd, if I remember correctly. He's also played on records and toured with like Blue Oyster Cult, Meatloaf, Hall & Oates, Cheap Trick, Patti Smyth, Patti Smith, Joan Jett, Richie Sambora. I mean, he's literally a rock star. He's been there and done it and seen it all. A couple of intense things. He talked about getting sober 28 years ago, but his journey into sobriety, as are many people who've gotten sober, is generally not a pretty one. They call it rock bottom for a reason. And he also talked about, if I remember, losing his wife, and he's got, I believe, 3 or 4 children. So that was pretty, some of this is difficult to process for me because I don't know, I can sit and empathize and say, I'm sorry, but I don't know what that's like, thank God, and I don't pretend to know and to walk in those footsteps. So some of the things that that people share with me, they're overwhelming. I feel very lucky that people are comfortable enough to talk about that stuff. But, some of it is just overwhelming. He also has a really good story about the first gig he had, which was basically opening up for Led Zeppelin at Nebworth in front of 150,000 people. And he's like, Linda and Paul McCartney are there. And it was just like, you know, rock celebrity kind of stuff. It was really interesting. He's a great guy, very candid, extremely professional, extremely well-respected, and a very well-rounded musician. So I think you're going to like this very much if you hadn't heard this the first time around. And even if you did, check it out again. It put a smile on your face. Take care and enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And I am with today just a fantastic guest, a tremendous musician, and arguably one of the most successful bass players in the history of rock and roll. I'm with Kazem Sultan. He is most well known for being the bass player, keyboardist, and vocalist in Todd Rundgren's Utopia. He played bass and sang lead vocals on Set Me Free, which was Utopia's only top 40 hit in the United States. During his time with Utopia, the band recorded 9 albums and toured extensively until disbanding in 1986, with occasional reunions to the present. And in fact, another tour was just announced, so I want everybody listening to this, by the time you finish this interview, you'll be in love with Kazem, and you need to go buy tickets to see Todd when he comes to the city near you. He's also toured with Blue Oyster Cult from 2012 to 2017. He toured with Meatloaf, and he played bass and sang background vocals on the breakout Meatloaf album, Bat Outta Hell, where after singing on and touring with Meatloaf in support of the Bat Outta Hell album, Kazem then became Meatloaf's music director, producer, and solo opening act for Meatloaf for several other albums and projects. He's also toured with Hall & Oates, Cheap Trick, Patti Smyth, and Richie Sambora, amongst many other artists. As a studio musician, he's played on albums by Patti Smith, the Indigo Girls, and Steve Stevens. He was also a member of Joan Jett's backing band, the Blackhearts, touring with them and playing on Jett's album Up Your Alley in 1988, as well as contributing a number of tracks to her compilation album The Hit List in 1990. He played bass in the Pit Orchestra for the Twyla Tharp choreographed musical based on Billy Joel music called Moving Out on Broadway. And after a brief stint with the reunited band Scandal, which was Patti Smyth, back in 2004, Sultan joined the New Cars in 2005, replacing original Cars bassist and co-lead vocalist Benjamin Orr, who passed away in 2000. An album, It's Alive, was followed by a tour in 2006 with Kazem singing lead on the Cars hit Drive. He's currently touring with his own band, and I'll tell you, if you want to see a really enjoyable show, go check out his Facebook page and watch the video from Daryl's Place in upstate New York. Man, he's just a phenomenal entertainer. He's got a real personal way of engaging with his audience. You know, he lets you know that he's just a really happy guy, and he's really, you know, happy that you're there to enjoy his music. He's got an amazing voice, even after performing for, what, 50 years of singing, probably?
Uh-oh, 50? Let's see, how old am I? Yeah, about 50 years.
50 years of singing and, like, maybe 50 cigars. And he's another one of my homies from New York City, man. So, and he's got great hair. So, man, thank you so much for coming on the show, Kazem.
Well, thanks for having me, Craig. I appreciate it.
How'd you first get involved in playing music, and what prompted you to get involved with the bass?
That's a long answer, and I'll try to make it as succinct as possible. My dad was a hobbyist, and he played guitar, and I grew up at a time when there were excuse me. There were about maybe 6 channels on television. It was Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7, Channel 9, and Channel 11, and then the public station, which was Channel 13.
13, yeah.
Yeah. So there wasn't a whole lot to do in the house. And after dinner at the table with my brothers and sister and mom and dad, my father would go out on the front porch the front porch and take his guitar, and we'd sing like stuff like Jimmy Crack Corn, On Top of Old Smokey, a bunch of Burl Ives stuff, spend quality family time together, and that was my first introduction to guitar playing. Of course, it was in the early 60s when everybody wanted to be a guitar player, and I wanted to be a guitar player too. And then I guess at 64, I was about 9 years old, and the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. And once I saw that, I knew that that's what I wanted to do in life. I didn't have to worry about, you know, doing my homework or going to school or figuring out if I wanted to be a doctor or a fireman or a policeman or an actuary. And I decided that I was going to be a musician. So I was about 11 years old. And I just decided that I was going, that was it. I was going to be a musician.
And how did you get to bass from wanting to play guitar?
I started playing electric guitar in bands around, you know, like little garage bands around my neighborhood. And, these two young guys, around the same age as me, moved to Staten Island, where I lived and grew up, from Brooklyn, and they were two hotshot guitar players from the Sheepshead Bay area in Brooklyn, and they wanted to start a band. I was going to, I guess it was junior high at the time, with one of the brothers. And he said to me, "We're starting a band. Would you like to play in our band?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely, of course." He said, "Well, what do you play guitar and rhythm guitar, lead guitar?" I said, "Well, I play rhythm guitar." And he said, "Well, we don't need a guitar player because me and my brother are the guitar players in the band. We need a bass player." And rather than not play with them because they happen to be good at what they did, I said, "Well, I can be the bass player." So I took the guitar that my dad got me a couple of 3 years prior to that for Christmas, and I sold it, and I bought a bass guitar, and I became the bass player.
Very cool.
About 6 months or a year later, I didn't have an amplifier. I used a conglomeration of, like, you know, stuff that people were throwing out. I didn't have a good amplifier, and they fired me because I didn't have an amplifier.
Oh.
And I went home, and I was literally crying that I got fired from a band. And because they got a bass player that had a brand new SVT. and I said, you know what, I'm going to show these guys. And I sat in my room for a year, and I did nothing but practice. And that's how I became a fairly decent bass player.
Wow, what a cool story. Did you ever run into these guys, like, later on?
And I still know them. I still see them every so often.
That's so I bet you they say, "Bye, we fucked up."
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe. They're really nice guys. I still care about them and love them very much. But I actually am very grateful that they did what they did, because it just kind of lit a fire under my behind to be as good as I possibly could be and put the time and effort into becoming a better musician.
That's great. Yeah, you know, righteous indignation goes a long way.
Yeah.
I hear you. Did you always sing, or, like, how did that come about? Because your voice really is good.
I sang by default. And no, I the only reason why I started singing was because nobody else wanted to. So rather than slow the whole process down and try to find a lead singer or stuff like that, I said, "Fine, I'll just sing. I'll sing the stuff." And that's how that started. I mean, I was a horrible, horrible singer at first. And only by doing it over and over again and finding, I guess, quote unquote, finding my voice, that's how I became a singer. So it wasn't because I wanted to, it was because I had to.
So I'm assuming you played in local bands through high school.
Mm-hmm.
You knew since that time you wanted to be a pro. What was the route for you? You know, you got out of high school. What was next to pursue music?
It was a very arduous task to go from playing five sets a night at Sonny's Lounge here on Staten Island and high school dances and, frat parties and beer blasts to try to make a little bit of a living. My dad, I guess I was about 17 or 18 years old, and I graduated high school, and I was kind of just knocking around in local bands here on Staten Island. My father said, you have two choices. Either you go back to school or you get a job. And I really didn't want to get a five day a week job punching a clock. And I was very, very worried that I wasn't going to be able to support myself, with, a $25 a night, putting my amplifier in somebody else's car and driving, a half an hour to a gig or an hour to a gig. So I got very lucky in that, I kind of wanted to expand my musical horizons, and I knew that by staying on Staten Island, it wasn't really going to help me. So I started going into Manhattan and playing in bands in Manhattan and expanding my network. And I got a very lucky break, actually playing piano. Because I had got myself a little upright piano that my then girlfriend, who later turned out to be my wife, she bought me an upright piano. I taught myself how to play piano, and then I heard about an audition with a girl by the name of Cherry Vanilla. Cherry was most known for her work as a publicist for David Bowie's record label, which was Main Man Records back in the early 70s. But she fancied herself a kind of a rock poetress, mm-hmm. and had a band. I auditioned for the band along with a friend of mine, a guy by the name of Jan Mullaney, who is an excellent keyboard player. So we both auditioned, and he just played me under the carpet. Yeah, he was great. But for whatever reasons, she decided that I would be the better person in her band. So through Cherry, I wound up meeting a bunch of New York heavyweight musicians, like people like Mick Ronson and Michael Kamen, I kind of hitched my wagon to those people, and did very well with them, and that's how I found out about the audition with Utopia, was through Michael Kamen.
Now, Michael Kamen is a movie guy, does soundtracks, correct?
Correct. Michael Kamen's passed. He passed. Got to be 15, 20 years ago. But he took a shine to me and kind of took me under his wing. And he's just a brilliant composer and a lovely, lovely man. When he got the call from Roger Powell, who was the keyboard player in Utopia, he mentioned it to another friend of mine, Earl Slick, who played guitar with David Bowie, and I gave him a lift to JFK Airport. Went to his house, gave him a lift to JFK Airport, and during that ride, he said, "Do you have any interest in playing guitar, playing bass for Todd Rundgren?" Because he knew me as a bass player. I said, "Yeah, sure, I'd certainly be interested in trying." He said, "Well, when we get to JFK, call Michael Kamen and let him know that you're interested, and he'll give you the details." I put a dime in a payphone at JFK, called Michael Kamen and said, "Michael, I heard that Todd Rundgren's looking for a bass player and that you knew about the audition, and I'd be interested in trying out." And he said, "What, you play bass?" He said, "I thought you were a piano player." I said, "Well, actually, bass is my main instrument. But I do play a little bit of piano. And he said, well, he said, all right, no problem. I'll recommend you hands down. And Roger will give you a call tomorrow. That's exactly what happened. The next day, Roger called me. I went up to a Woodstock. The following day, I had to borrow $20 from my uncle to take an Adirondack Trailways bus from the Port Authority up to Woodstock. Roger picked me up. I learned a couple of songs and played the material through with Roger and Willie Wilcox, the drummer. The next day, Todd was on a mopeding trip through South India. had just gotten back, and
that sounds very rock star.
Yeah, and he didn't want me in the band. He didn't think that I had any experience. I had never been on the road before. I'd never recorded a record. I'd done some recording in New York, but my resume was non-existent. And he decided that I wouldn't be the best person for the band. Fortunately enough for me, Roger and Willie said, well, you know, we think he'd be great. And unless you want to get another keyboard player and drummer, we want to give this guy a shot. So Todd begrudgingly took me into the band, and the rest is kind of my history.
Wow. What a great story, man. Fuck that. Yeah, cool.
It was weird.
I thought Mick Ronson was from the UK.
He is, but yeah. He lived in New York at the time.
Okay. I didn't realize that. Wow. Yeah. What had Todd been doing at the time?
Well, Todd had just finished recording his kind of, I don't want to say tribute record, but he did a record called Faithful. One side was all original material, and the flip side was his homage to artists and bands that he liked growing up. I think he did a version of Good Vibrations, a bunch of other, five or six other artists that he liked. And that was with the bass player John Siegler, who left right after that record. And then Todd, you know, was still doing his solo work and wanted to spend more time working with Utopia. Hmm. So he was looking to kind of expand his musical horizon with in prog rock and with a four-piece, more democratic band than his solo work.
Once you came on board with that kind of not shaky start, but you know, it wasn't endearing, at least from Todd. It was from the other two guys. Was it okay, or did you still feel in the beginning like you had to prove yourself, or was he good with, you know, let the cards lay, or, you know, be open to you?
It was difficult. You know, Todd's not a very warm and fuzzy guy. He doesn't dole out platitudes doesn't make you feel like you're doing a good job unless you're not doing a good job, and then you're the first person to know about it. So it was difficult because I'm the kind of person that really appreciates and likes pats on the back every once in a while.
Sure.
And I really wasn't getting that. And it was hard, you know, it was hard. I'd never been away from home other than, you know, a couple of weeks in the Adirondacks with the next door neighbors and down at the Jersey Shore for a few days here and there with the family. Hmm. And then all of a sudden I'm on planes and flying to England and Germany and playing in front of 150,000 people at Nebworth with Led Zeppelin one weekend. And then the next weekend, the Rolling Stones were opening for 10cc and what was the Keith Richards side project at that time was I forget.
Steal something?
No, it was, the name escapes me right now. I can't think of it. It was culture shock for me. And something that, I wasn't really used to. So it took a little bit of getting used to, but I guess I kind of grew into it real quickly, because you don't really have a choice.
Right.
So as hard as it was, I kind of made the best of it and did the best that I possibly could. And, that was the beginning of my career.
Did you at least like those two, the other two guys, were you able to bond closely with them? Because you seem like you are like a warm and fuzzy guy and you want to have those kinds of connections. And I would imagine it would have been like important to have some sort of support there. Were you able to forge that with the other two guys?
Everybody has their own comfort level, and the other guys were like, "Hey, you know what are you complaining about? You're here. You're playing in a nationally known rock band. You're making some decent money, and get over yourself." I was still a kid. I was only 20 years old.
Yeah, it's very young.
So I was, I did my best, and I tried as hard as I could to acclimate myself to this new lifestyle. But it's like, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it.
Yeah.
Exactly what happened. I got it, and I'm like, "Well, wait a second. This isn't all it's cracked up to be. This is a lot of hard work."
Yeah.
So I struggled at first, and I actually left the band 6 months into I left the band 6 months after I joined because I didn't feel like I was being treated with respect. And it was just before our Nebworth show, and I remember I remember making the phone call. I was at my wife's parents' house, and I was like, I'm just so unhappy in this organization. And I remember calling Todd and saying, "Listen, I'm going to have to leave, because I'm just not feeling it." He said, "Okay, no problem. We'll find somebody else." And
not exactly what you were hoping to hear, but
well, I didn't think I was going to be begged to stay.
Sure.
When you put stuff like that out there, you have to be prepared for people to say, "Listen, I respect your wishes, and you can move on, and so will we."
Right, right.
And anyway, I said, "I'll do the next gig with you guys, but after that, I'm gone." And I remember flying to England for the Nebworth show, and it was the second time that we did Nebworth, and I was summoned into Todd's room for a conversation just before we left the hotel for the gig. We had a conversation. I cannot for the life of me remember what the conversation was about. The only thing I do remember was rejoining. So whatever we said to each other in that conversation, I said, "Okay, I'll give it a shot. I'll rescind my resignation and I'll come back into the band." And then I stayed.
Did he give you like some sort of a verbal hug or?
I guess as close as you could get in his world to a verbal hug. Yeah, that's what I got. Yeah. All I remember is that I decided that I was gonna stick around for a while.
It really, when you're 20, really your coping skills are. I mean, unless you've had an unusual and you're an unusual person, and unless you have had an unusual upbringing, you really don't have very good coping skills.
Well, you know, your comfort level is, yeah, well, your comfort level is narrow, you know, it's, and when you're out of it, I guess at that age, you're just a little like you're kind of blowing in the wind, you know, you don't really know which way to turn. You're thrust into a situation where you have to become an adult. And, I guess I wasn't ready to become an adult yet.
Yeah.
I'm still not on some level.
I think, all of us are.
Not yeah. You know, it's really about just accepting what the universe has put in front of you, as opposed to, you know, kicking and screaming about it. And I was kicking and screaming.
Yeah. That's a tough thing. I know, like, when I sort of stopped that, life got a lot less stressful, oddly enough. When you stop trying to be so, like, willful and, like...
I guess on some level you just have to, you know, and what I've learned is that you're better off choosing consciousness over compulsion.
<You know? laughs> Yeah, man. Well, man, thank you for sharing. That was a really interesting story. I want to ask you, you mentioned that you opened up for Zeppelin, the Stones, 10cc, and Keith Richards. Any cool stories about interacting with any of those guys, or did you get a chance
to
talk
with them? I do have a story. Paul McCartney was at one of the shows. I think it was the Rolling Stones. It's a big, huge outdoor festival that they held every year in the UK, just outside of London, about an hour outside of London. And I remember walking into they have tents set up all over the backstage area for dressing rooms, catering, wardrobe, stuff like that. And I walked into the catering tent, and about 15 yards in front of me, I see Todd, and he's sitting with Paul and Linda.
Surreal? Is that weird? Is that like
it was at the time? Yeah. And I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I credit the Beatles with, you know, as the impetus for me deciding that that's what I want to do in life. So I walked up to him and I whispered in his ear. I said, "If you don't introduce me to him, to Paul McCartney right now, I'm going to go home." And he said, "You know," he said, "Oh, okay." I think it's Paul. And this is Kasim Sultan, our bass player, the bass player in Utopia. And then Todd got up and left, and I sat down, and I had a lovely, lovely 20-minute conversation with Paul and Linda. We spoke about. He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Oh, I live on Staten Island." And he says, "Oh, yes, we took the ferry. Linda and I took the ferry not long ago." We talked about bass guitars, and just couldn't have been a nicer exchange. And I'm very, very grateful for those 20 minutes with Paul.
That's so cool. Have you ever had a chance to bump into him since then?
No, absolutely not. And it's funny because I've come close a few times, but never really had the chance to talk to him one-on-one again. And I would always like to know if he remembers that, you know, meeting me. I mean, he meets thousands and thousands of people. Not long after that, Roger Powell, the keyboard player in
Deep Purple.
Roger Powell was the keyboard player in Utopia.
Oh, okay.
Was he had a stint with Queen when Freddie was still alive, and he was the keyboard player on stage with Queen for a tour, and he wound up on the Concorde from New York to England to go play some shows. And Paul McCartney was on the Concorde, and they said hello to each other. And this is what Roger told me. And Roger said, he said, "Kasim, I swear to God," he said, "by the way, that bass player in Utopia, he's still in your band? Rod says, yeah. You mean Chasm? Yeah. He says, and Paul said, oh, he's a lovely young man. Send my regards.
How cool is that, man? Well, Paul, if you're listening to this, get a hold of Chasm and shoot the shit with him for 20 minutes again. I think you both have a good conversation. That's really cool, man. Very cool. Yeah. Wow, what a cool story, man. Thank you. Talk about, I'm going to throw out some names, and if you could talk about how you got the gig, and then, you know, I'm noticing my New York accent is slightly coming back talking to you.
Sorry.
I haven't had it in, my wife's from the UK, I certainly don't get it from her. how you got the gig and the nature of what you were doing with them, and maybe if you have a cool story or two about working with them, and if you happen to have any takeaways or maybe something you learned either about performance or about business or whatever. Meatloaf.
Meatloaf. I first met Meat, which he likes to be called, or he's okay with people calling him Meat, when we did the Bat Out of Hell record, the first one. And I remember I was living in Woodstock at the time because that's where the band lived, Utopia. And I was sharing a house with Roger Powell, the keyboard player. The phone rang one morning and, it was Todd, and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, nothing. I'm just, you know, I'm just hanging. He said, I'm recording an artist. He said, do you want to play bass on the record? I said, yeah, sure. No problem. He said, all right, well, you know, the session, the rehearsals start, tomorrow at 1 o'clock. At the accountant's office up in Bearsville. I said,
Bearsville, that's where his studios were, right?
Yeah. If you don't mind me asking, I said, what's the artist's name? He said, it's a guy named Meatloaf. I said, okay, Todd, you know, stop messing around. Stop screwing around. Tell me what the guy's name is. And I'll be, he said, just show up at the accountant's office. So I went there and there's, Jim Steinman, who wrote all the material, music and lyrics, and Rory Dodd, one of the background singers, Ellen Foley, who is another background singer, and Meatloaf. And they proceeded to play the entire record for us, three of them, just with an upright piano, with Jim playing the upright piano, Meatloaf singing the stuff, and Rory and Ellen singing backgrounds. And I remember it was me, Todd, Roy Bittan, who's a piano player with Bruce Springsteen, and Max Weinberg, the drummer with the E Street Band.
Yeah.
And we kind of sat there with our mouths agape, like, this stuff is just out. It's out there. And we did we rehearsed the music together, and we recorded the basic tracks in about 2 weeks. And then I never heard it again after they finished, after we finished the background parts and I did some background vocals, the basic tracks and I did some background vocals. About a year and a half later, maybe it was even 2 years later, I was driving in my car from Staten Island to Woodstock to start a, Utopia record. And at that time, there was a very popular radio station here in New York City called WNEW.
102.7. Scott Muni,
Allison Steele, bunch of other famous disc jockeys. And I something comes on the radio, and I said, geez, that sounds oddly familiar. Where have I heard that before? And I said, oh, yeah, right. That's the record that I recorded a year and a half ago with Todd. Oh, isn't that nice? They got their record on the radio. now cut to 2017 and 47 million records later. I mean, that's just a number that's pulled out of the air constantly. It's one of the, I think it's either the third or fourth largest selling album of all time. Just next to Dark Side of the Moon and Thriller. And I was, you know, I was like, oh, well, that's great. That's really, really great. We did the next record a couple of years later. We started what was then Bat Outta Hell 2, which ended disastrously. And then I really didn't see Meatloaf again until 1990, I think it was 1990 or 91, when I was in Australia with, I was playing with Hall & Oates at the time, which was a great experience for me. One of the best bands that I've ever been in was that particular lineup with Hall & Oates. It was myself, Mike Braun on drums, Bobby Mayo on keyboards, T-Bone Walk on guitar, Daryl and John, and Charlie DeChant, who has played with Daryl and John forever. We were in Australia doing a tour, staying at the Intercontinental in Sydney. I went to breakfast one morning, and there's Meatloaf in the breakfast room. I was like, Meat, how you doing? Oh, hi, Cassie. How's it going? Good, good. It's so good to see you. He's like, yeah, it's really good to see you. He said, by the way, we're doing another record, Bat Outta Hell 3. Oh, and Bat Outta Hell 2. I'm sorry. They went back to Bat Outta Hell 2. He said, I'm going out on the road with it. Would you like to come and play guitar and keyboards in the band? I need a utility guy. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. 6 months later, I wound up it was 1992 and a half or something like that, 1993. And I started playing with Meatloaf in his live band, and I wound up in that band for 17 years.
That's awesome. Now, do you think was it happenstance that he happened to bump into you and he said, shit, I need to get Chasm? Or do you think was he going to call you? Or because I always wonder how these things, you know, I'm always in a marvel of how the universe works like that. Like, you know, boom, you're in Australia and he's in Australia and then you get the gig.
It's just one of those happenstance things. It's just one of those lucky accidents that, you know, you're in the right place at the right time. Somebody remembers you. Somebody puts two and two together and says, I need this spot filled. Oh, this guy, you know, the universe puts you in that yeah. spot. And then it's up to you to make it whatever you can out of it. So it was just like a happy accident.
Yeah, that's so cool. I'm embarrassed. I interviewed who played guitar on that. I interviewed the guitar player who was on there recently.
On Bat Outta Hell 2?
Bat Outta Hell 1.
That was old Todd.
Who toured?
There were two guys, Bruce Kulick and Bob Kulick.
Boom, Bruce Kulick. I'm interviewing him next week, and I'm like, I know I just went through
Bruce
this.
Is great.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
great. I love Bruce. Yeah. He's a really wonderful guy.
Yeah, he was pretty funny when we spoke initially. I think I'm interviewing him Monday, and I'm like, shit, I just went through this, and I was okay, good. Since you talk so highly about it, Hall & Oates, how'd you get the gig with them and a story about working with them?
Well, I've known Daryl and John for years because of the Todd connection, and we did some shows together in the 70s, Utopia and Hall & Oates, a friend of mine who was on their crew, a guy by the name of Tom Permy, was working with them. They had just finished their record Change of Seasons, which was a kind of a hearkening back to their earlier days of softer, more acoustic material. And they were putting a band together. T-Bone didn't want to play bass. He wanted to play acoustic guitar. And Tom said, I know a bass player that might fit well. Mentioned my name. And Dallas and John said, oh, yeah, Chasm. Is he available? Tom said, I don't know, let's call him. And I went up and played with the band up in their studio in Pauling, New York. It worked out well. We had a little bit of a history together. So I wound up in that band for about 2.5 years, maybe 3 years tops.
And you really enjoyed that band.
I loved working with Daryl and John. They're just the sweetest guys in the whole world. Very respectful, very accommodating and just really good guys to be around and great, great, great music.
Yeah, really good songwriters, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Blue Oyster Cult.
Well, again, I've known the guys in Blue Oyster Cult from the early, well, the mid-70s when we did a tour together of Utopia and Blue Oyster Cult. We toured from Vancouver, Canada to Toronto. We did a like a four-week tour in the middle of the winter.
Nice.
yeah, so it wasn't very nice. A bus tour across Canada. And we became close, and I remained close with Eric Bloom and Donald, Buck Dharma. Mm-hmm. I did some fill in work with them here and there, over the years when they needed a utility guy. Never really played bass with them until, Rudy Sarzo was their bass player at the time, and Rudy wanted to leave to pursue other projects. So Donald gave me a call and asked me if I'd be interested. I was what was I doing at the time? I had just left Meatloaf's band. It was 2011. I just left Meat, and I said, "Yeah, sure." And I wound up in the band for 6 years. I love those guys. They're great, great guys to be around and to work with. It was a really great experience being in that band, and I'm very, very grateful and thankful that I got to work with them for so long.
Great rock songs, man.
Really great stuff. And I didn't discover this until just recently, but I just did a cruise. They have these cruises now that that everybody seems to be really latching on to. We did a Rock Legends cruise. I was with Todd. It was just last week. And Blue Oyster Cult was on the boat as well. And
I went
to see them. Yeah, I went to see one of their shows. And I just realized, sitting and watching their show, is that they're a jam band.
Yeah.
You know? They stretch out, they jam, and I'm like, yeah, I was in a jam band for 6 years. That's really cool.
And they're from Long Island, I think, right?
Yes, they are. Yeah,
yeah. Right. Because I remember when I was a kid, there was a big to do one time when there was Soft White Underbellies appearing, but that was their original name.
Yes, that was from the 60s, actually. I think it was 68 or 69 that they started Soft White Underbelly.
Yeah, and they were playing like a, you know, a gig to get ready for a tour.
Uh-huh.
You know, one of those big bars they used to have on the island. I can't think of the names now. You've been taking me a walk down memory lane here, all the radio stations.
It was like My Father's Place.
Yeah, My Father's Place, something like that. One of those big clubs on the island that they used to have. And I remember that was a big thing. And I was like, who's Soft White Underbelly? And of course, the next day you heard it was, you know, on NEW, I probably heard it, or PLJ.
Right.
You know, it was Blue Oyster Cult. So. You've done and been involved in so many cool projects, and I was curious for you, what would be the top three experiences you had musically? Like, which ones left you most satisfied as a musician?
I guess there was a couple of Utopia records, or there was one in particular, the Adventures in Utopia record that we did in 79. It was 1979. It was released in 1980. We recorded it in 79. And I thought that was a really, really satisfying record musically. The songs, the arrangements, the production, that was the peak of our working together as a band. I'm very, very proud of that record. In terms of other bands, I produced a Meatloaf record, the Storytellers, right? The VH1 Storytellers. That was an interesting experience. I worked alongside, Frank Filippetti, who mixed the record. But being a producer on a Meatloaf record is a pretty, you know, that's a feather in your cap.
Is that hard to do, to produce a guy like him? Because he seems like, you know, a very dynamic. Is he open to suggestions and stuff like that? Because he seems like a big personality.
Well, you know, I mean, when it comes to, in that particular instance, it wasn't really like I shaped anything other than I took the raw material and made a record out of it. It wasn't that I made any suggestions of direction or song selection or I wasn't involved in the actual formation of it, but I was seriously involved in the putting it out, you know, and getting it out and finishing the project after it was recorded.
Sure. Okay, so Adventures in Utopia, Storytellers with Meatloaf. What would be the third?
God, I'm so proud of everything that I've done, pretty much. I don't know. I can't really put my finger on any one particular thing that I'm more proud of than another.
Fair enough. Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. You grew up in Staten Island, normal New York City childhood growing up there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, pretty much. As normal as what's normal?
What's normal? Know? Yeah, right. Normal, you know, is a setting on the.
Yeah, I got the belt if I came in late, and I never wanted to go to school.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a normal upbringing.
One of the things I admire about you is, you know, you're a survivor, man. You've had a lot of hurdles to deal with, and I like survivors. I know you got sober quite a while back now, and I was just wondering if you could talk about that for a minute.
Sure.
What was your drug of choice at that time?
When I got sober?
You pick.
Well, you know, I started in this business professionally when I was, like I said, when I was 20 years old. I don't know if you want to call, you know, playing in bar bands and knocking around New York City in various iterations of other people's bands professional. I guess I was just cutting my teeth when I was 17, 18, 19 years old. But I certainly wasn't doing anything else. I didn't have a day job. That my job was playing music. But it wasn't until I started making records and touring that I considered myself a professional. I guess I was, that was a time when it was acceptable behavior to be out of control.
Hmm.
Was everybody like that? No. Was it okay to be like that? On some level it was. On some level it was accepted, you know. Oh, you're a rock guy, you know, so you must be, you know, get drunk and get high and for lack of a better term, it's okay to hurt yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't want to say I was making a lot of money. I was making really good money. And basically it afforded me the ability to damage myself. I don't know how else to put it. And I started with alcohol. I mean, I started with drinking when I was 14 years old. Hmm. You know, so I remember... a friend of mine, me and my friend having a bottle of Jack Daniels and just falling down drunk, on the lawn of the local high school, And the world is doing Mach 1 in circles. And I just said, this is great.
this nothing is great. Better.
and on some level, I had found my best friend in terms of alcohol. And yeah, I smoked pot when I was, you know, when I was 14, 15, 16 years old. And there was the you know, the pills, the amphetamines, and I was never really an opiate kind of guy. I didn't like taking something that was going to make me go to sleep. I wanted to stay awake.
So you liked the rush.
So then when I became, you know, a little bit more successful, I just could afford more, you know, more alcohol and more drugs. My drug of choice at the time was cocaine. And I did a lot of it and I drank a lot. I'll never forget. There was one time on stage with Utopia that Todd and I, we used to share, Harvey's Bristol Cream. Oh my God. And we did a show up in Connecticut at a place called Shaboo's. It was a club, a very popular club in Connecticut, and we drank an entire bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream while we were on stage.
Good Lord!
You know, I mean, during the show, between songs,
is that like Bailey's or something? I remember always hearing the commercials.
It's kind of like a port.
Okay,
it's like a really sweet. Liqueur, it's not a liqueur. Maybe it is. I don't know. But it was just disgusting. and unfortunately, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Which are really one and the same thing. And I got away with it for a very, very long time. When Utopia broke up in 1986, I went into a kind of a deep depression, and that saw my drug abuse increase. And once you go down that road, it's a little difficult to pull yourself out of it. So I remained an active addict until 1989, at which point I had turned to I was a freebase addict. I smoked cocaine. Oh, this is horrible. I smoked cocaine, and I was it was really, really bad. Hmm. It was really bad for a really long time. I had an intervention done by my family on me, and I went to a rehab in Florida, and I have been sober since July 3rd, 1989 was the last time I did any drugs.
Man, congratulations.
It's 28 years, 28 and a half years of really... sobriety that I am so incredibly, extremely proud of the fact that I don't do that anymore. But the alternative is very depressing.
Right.
If I would ever, you know, if I would even be here right now, had I not gotten clean when I did.
Man, I'm so happy for you.
And I'm happy for you too.
Congratulations. Well, it's a tough thing to do. And especially the first time in, as you know, that's unusual.
I was scared. I was scared to death. I had no intention of stopping when I went to rehab. I thought I would just take a little bit of a vacation. And then about 2 weeks in, I think I had some kind of moment of clarity. And one of the things that that happened was there was a group, and the one of the counselors said there was about 30 guys sitting around, sitting in a circle, and they said, "Take a look around. Out of the 30 of you, three of you there's only three people here that'll make it through their first year. The rest of you are going to use again." I was like, "What are you telling me that for? Why are you saying, you know, why did you say that? That's, you're scaring the shit out of me." And that frightened me so deeply that, because at that point I was like, you know what? I feel okay. I'm not itching to get out of my own skin. I feel a little clearer than I ever have before in the last 20 years. Mm. 'Cause that's how long I used for 20 years. And I kind of liked the way I felt. And I was like, you know what? I want this. I want to do this. This is a good thing. It's not something that I need to stop feeling. So I wanted to continue that good feeling of not having a drug in my body, not being chained to a dealer, or, you know, or how I'm going to get high, or when I'm going to get high, or who I'm going to get high with, or when the worst part is running out, you know. And I hated that. I hated it so much. And the countless number of times that I said, "I will never do this again. That's it. Never, ever, ever do this again." And then the next day I'd start that, the maddening process all over again.
Mm. Well, do you think, I'm wondering, you know, that story came to mind that you said when those guys fired you and you said, you know, "Okay, fuckers, I'm going to sit here and practice." And I'm wondering if there was the same effect when that guy said, "Well, only three of you." And I wonder if you maybe said, "Well, I'm, you know, like that's, yeah.
I'll show me."
Yeah, I'll show me, right.
You know, that's a very, very interesting observation. I think that you're probably right. I never really looked at it like that. I never thought about it like that. But I do think that, there's something in me that when I get a wild hair, you know, that I'm determined to do something, that I will do it. And the best part is when it's good for you, you know, it makes it all the more satisfying.
Yeah.
And I've just been able to become a functioning member of society now, as opposed to being just a rotten old drunk and chained to a drug.
I'm really happy for you, man. Thank you.
Thanks.
For sharing.
Thanks.
This, man. Yeah, you're an awesome guy. Do you still go to meetings?
Still go to meetings.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. I've interviewed a lot of musicians that have gotten sober, and they say, you know, they always go to meetings a lot of them go to meetings when they're out of town. And the common saying is, "Well, shit, I was able to find the dope man. I should be able to find a meeting."
Yeah. I go to meetings all over the place. Yeah. I've been to meetings in all of Europe and, Singapore, Japan, Kuala Lumpur. Most everywhere I go, I can find a meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. Good, man. Then you had another tragedy in 2011 when you lost your wife. And I know we talked before. I can't tell you how, you know, I'm just so sorry that you had it for you and your girls. I don't even know if this question makes sense, but how do you even, like, where do you start after something like that happens? Like, with the healing process for you and your girls? I mean,
it was the most difficult time of my life. It was an incredibly, incredibly sad and horrible, horrible thing to happen that you don't wish on anyone. My children suffered the most because their mom was taken away from them. She was a wonderful person. She was full of love, funny, easy to get along with, but she was in poor health, and she was suffering, and the the bigger plan in life, no one has any control over. And it was her time to go. I miss her terribly, but I didn't want to see her in pain any longer.
Thanks. That was really good of you to share that. And, we don't know each other, but I can't tell you, I'm so like kind of proud of you for going through all this shit.
Well, you know, you don't really have a choice. You don't. I don't want to pat myself on the back. There's nothing to pat yourself on the back for in this particular conversation. But I had to step up to the plate and take care of my kids. And a lot of people thought that I would kind of duck and run for cover. But my children are the most important thing in the world to me, and they needed a dad because they lost their mom. So I had to step up to the plate and take care of them, which I did gladly and gratefully, and still do to this day. I also had a few people in my life that. That I couldn't have made it through that particular experience without, and they know who they are. So, I'm grateful for the people that I held close, and I don't know what I would have done without them. One person in particular, or a couple people in particular.
I'm glad you had them, and I'm glad you got through it, and I'm glad your kids are okay.
Thanks.
I want to talk about your music.
Sure.
You got 4 really good albums out, and I want to talk about some of the tracks off your most recent album, Live Bootleg, which came out last year.
Yeah.
So first of all, for people who aren't familiar with Chasm's music, it's really cool, happy pop rock and roll. It is. It is. I was trying to think, how do I describe it? It's like, well, it's really happy. You're a happy guy. You're very, energetic and effusive and enthusiastic in what you're doing. You're giving 110%, and it's good pop rock and roll, you know?
Thank you.
Great melodies, amazing vocals. The songs make you feel good. Like I said, loads of positive energy. So I'd encourage everybody to go out and buy and at least listen to Chasm's stuff if you aren't already a fan. I think the second half of the record, I heard you say something in there. It was recorded in San Francisco.
Yeah, there are, I think, about 2 or 3 tracks that were from the Hotel Utah in San Francisco, which is a small club that everybody plays at down in the Mission District.
And where was the first half recorded?
Joe's Pub.
Up in downtown.
On Lafayette Street.
Yeah. Did you write all those songs?
I have to look at a copy. I believe I did. If I didn't write them by myself, I co-wrote them. I think there's a couple of there's at least one song. There's one song that I did not write. There's a couple of people I like working with. Who I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable sharing. Half-baked ideas and unfinished songs with. And one of the guys is a guy by the name of Phil Thornalley. He's a British songwriter. He's written some amazing, amazing songs. And we write a lot together. I co-wrote at least 4 or 5 songs on my last record, 3, with him. Record before Live Bootleg. He wrote a song called Yellow Cab that's on Live Bootleg that is a kind of a fan favorite, and that's on there. So, yeah, Phil wrote Yellow Cab.
There's three songs I wanted to talk about. Yellow Cab was one of them. That's like a love story set in New York City, basically, right?
I mean, it could be wherever you like, but, you know, I think Phil's idea was that it was probably New York. It was probably the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah, that's what I thought, the Brooklyn Bridge.
It was probably that. But, you know, it's like with any kind of music or any kind of material, you don't want to really label it. You want to allow the listener to put their own image on top of a piece of music or lyric.
Is there a backstory to that or anything in particular? Just okay.
No.
15 minutes. Great.
Yeah.
Great rock melody, great bass line running through the background. And I was just curious, is there a backstory to that song?
Yeah. I'm fascinated with the whole genre of reality TV. And my middle daughter, her name is Cassandra. I think she was about 14 at the time, maybe a little bit older, maybe 16. I don't know. She came up to me one day and she said, Pa, because they call me Pa. She said, I want to be famous. I said, well, good for you, Cassandra. You want to be famous? That's great. She said, what do you want? I said, what do you want to be famous for? She said, I don't know. Why do I have to be famous for something? I just want to be famous. And I think that speaks to this subculture, not even a subculture, to the culture of being famous for doing nothing.
Yeah.
And it is the Kardashians. It started with Paris Hilton and, the Real Housewives, the reality television, it's like you're famous for nothing.
Right.
Yeah, you've done nothing. You have not contributed one iota to society or to making society a better place. But yet you're widely popular. You know, you have millions of Twitter followers and Instagram followers and Facebook followers and people that hang on your every word. But what are you famous for? What have you done? You know, what you put together a perfume or, you know, or a doll or it's amazing what piques people's interest these days. And it's basically, you know, the mess that other people have made of their lives.
So 15 minutes is in 15 minutes of fame.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
I mean, it harkens back to the Andy Warhol. That's where it comes from. Yeah. Where Andy Warhol said, you know, sometime in the future, everybody is going to be famous for 15 minutes.
Yeah. You know, interesting that you said that. I read last year a very lengthy article on this whole phenomenon, and they reckon that O.J. Simpson started this. And if you think back to, you know, in 94, when he was getting arrested, that's when this whole fanfare with celebrity nothingness did kind of come out.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I certainly don't want to defend a murderer, but I think at least OJ contributed something to, his being famous in the fact that he was a tremendous football player. And I think, I don't know that anybody rushed as, had more rushing yards. He's like in the top 10.
Yeah.
So at least OJ, you know, did something, aside from the fact that, you know, I think he's a murderer,
right.
You know, which is a terrible thing to pin something on. But at least he can say, well, I did this,
right?
You know?
Right.
I was a tremendous athlete,
as opposed to the Kardashians.
who are, you know, I just think abhorrent.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that, man. That's not my thing. You know, another great song in there called God of Low.
Uh-huh.
Is that you on piano?
That is.
Yeah, I thought so. Great riffs there. Do you write on piano in general, usually?
I vacillate between piano and guitar. So I go through phases. Some days I'm writing on guitar, and some days I'm writing on piano. It's usually the phase is usually more than a day or two. It's like there'll be a few months where I'm kind of hashing out ideas on piano, and then there'll be a few months where I'm just playing guitar.
That metaphor, God of Low, I thought that was pretty intense, and I was curious how you came up with that. What's like the backstory on that one?
Oh, I was pissed off at somebody.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
I was just really pissed off.
You did a good job there, man.
Yeah, I'd rather now allow people.
You don't have to tell the story, but
to their own conclusions.
Yeah, that was a really good metaphor.
You know, and that's usually the better songs are that's how they come about, is that you feel strongly enough about something that you want to express the sentiment in a piece of music for a songwriter. You know,
I want to ask you three more questions, Kazem. I really appreciate everything. One, what's something you've learned about yourself along this whole journey?
I mean, I'm still learning stuff about myself, you know. I like to make people happy. I like to make people laugh. I like to make people smile. And I like everybody in life, I want to be loved. I think more so as I get older, it's about not doing things that hurt other people, and being conscious of decisions and not making choices that haven't been thought out. You know, there's always consequences to every decision that you make, and it's good to make decisions that when you put your head on the pillow at night, you feel good about yourself. And that's what I strive for, and that's where my focus has been on just trying to be a really good person, you know. It's not always easy, because it's a lot easier to feel like, to feel put upon, to feel that you're not getting a fair shake, that you're that you're being taken advantage of, it's a lot harder to say I'm okay. You know, I'm okay with the way things are. And as long as I do the right thing will happen.
Yeah. There's a lot of wisdom, like, I talked to other people about, there's a lot of wisdom in those little, you know, do the next right thing, those kinds of things from the 12-step program that I think are pretty valuable for, like, everybody, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that one.
I think it really boils down to, you know, just being honest with yourself, and there are people that are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves.
Right.
But most people, in my opinion, can smell bullshit a mile away, you know. I don't want to be one of those people that others say he's full of shit, you know. So therefore, the best way to combat
there's nothing about you that comes off like that for whatever that's worth. So I
am no angel. I'm not perfect. I struggle on a daily basis with a lot of stuff, but I try my best to be as honest as I possibly can at any given point.
Yeah, I think you do a great job. I mean, again, I don't know you very well, but I mean, I got a really good.
You know, I'm a human being. I'm filled with flaws, and you know, stuff that I wish I was better at and could change. And it's a process, you know. It's a, being a human being is a process.
Oh, hell yeah. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm a good cook.
Oh, cool. What do you like to cook?
I love cooking. I love to cook.
What do you cook, man? What's your specialty or what do you enjoy cooking?
I have this one dish that I really, that is my go-to dish. It's a penne with broccoli rabe and Italian hot sausage in an olive oil and garlic.
Oh, my God. That sounds pretty good between that and the cigar. You're corrupting
it's
me here.
Really good. It's really good. What you have to do is you have to cook the sausage very, very slow. And I'm not a big, huge meat eater. Hmm. As a matter of fact, I've been trying to cut down on my meat consumption. Vegan would be great. But
it's a job, though, man.
It really is. And in any case, I know a lot of vegans. This one friend of mine, this guy by the name of Greg Saran, is an amazing guitar player.
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah. Greg's a great guy. And we got close because we both worked with Don Felder. He no longer works with Don. But in any case, he is a strict vegan. And, you know, it's like you go into a restaurant and it's like, well, is this done? What kind of broth do they use in this? And what kind of this is? And I was like, is that, how is that prepared? And it's like, I forget where that was going, but I love to cook. I make a really good eggplant parmesan. I'm a good cook.
Awesome, man. And last question, and you might have answered this, so if you did, that's cool. What's the biggest change in your personality been over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been deliberate and how much has just been a natural part of aging?
How much has my personality changed?
No, what's the biggest change in your personality, and how much of that is attributable to like deliberate change on your part, or how much of it is just a natural part of aging?
I think as you get older, your level of acceptance, or for me, my level of acceptance has risen. You know, do you know what I mean? Yes. So it's if someone's being a total fucking asshole, it's like, hey, dude, you know what? You're entitled.
Yeah, it's your stuff.
You just don't, you know, but I'm also entitled not to be around you.
Right.
And it's also with stuff that used to frustrate me, like if I'm waiting for something or if I'm expecting something to happen and it doesn't happen, I've really, really done a lot of work in trying to be just accepting of the moment, you know, and not freak out because something's not going the way that I want it to.
I hear you, man. Listen, I want to, I can't thank you enough for your time and for sharing you. I want to congratulate you, man, for the incredible career you've had and for this, the person you are, because it takes a lot of work to be a good person.
Well, thank you.
As you know,
I really appreciate it. I'm, like I said, I'm far from being a perfect human being. I try my best to be a good person.
I think you're doing a good job. Great job.
Well, you know, yeah. Catch me on a bad day.
Yeah. Catch us all. I want to tell everybody, again, check out Chasm Sultan and go to his website, chasmsultan.com. It's KASIMSULTON.com. And check out his CDs. It's chasmsultan.com/KASCDS, like CASCDS.html. You can check him out on Facebook and look online for Ticketmaster to check out Utopia. They are coming touring right now, and you need to go out and support them and see how cool Chasm is and listen to his voice and everything that's cool that he does. Any final words of wisdom, man?
No, just be good to each other.
That's great. Thank you again, everybody.
Thank you, Craig.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Kasman Sultan for generous time and compassion and sharing. I certainly appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with early product announcements and discount. And remember, most important, happiness is a choice. So be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.